Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I cannot believe we're already well into season three. We have so many people lined up for the rest of the season, including today's guest, Jasmine. Jasmine is a registered nurse certified in inpatient obstetrics. She's a certified lactation counselor and an internationally board certified lactation consultant. She's been working as a nurse in frontline healthcare for almost 20 years. That's a long time. Jasmine's calling as a birth worker was influenced by growing up in her rural childhood home where she saw a mare give birth to her first foal. Her decision to pursue a career in maternal child health was then solidified when Jasmine witnessed the power and the strength of a woman's body during a hospital birth of a family friend. Jasmine's own parenting journey sparked a passion for patient advocacy, trauma-aware care, and promoting evidence-based practice. This personal role as a mother also shifted her focus on the need for comprehensive lactation support. Jasmine believes that lifelong health and strong family relationships start with pregnancy and birth. Families today are facing almost insurmountable struggles when it comes to navigating the healthcare system, juggling the demands of a new baby with no paid parental leave, and the lack of postpartum and breastfeeding support. These struggles show in maternal and infant mortality rates, infant feeding outcomes, and increasing rates of postpartum depression. All of these things we plan on discussing today. Jasmine currently works to change birth culture by offering continuing education classes to healthcare providers through her consulting business and serving on the United States Lactation Association Advisory Board. She's also the current president of the Alaskan Breastfeeding Coalition. And when she's not doing all wonderful things birth and breastfeeding, she enjoys composing and performing live music, sewing, foraging, and spending time in nature with her husband and four daughters. And it is for them that she labors in the heavy work of improving the current state of maternal child healthcare. Welcome to Venus Rising, Jasmine. I am so excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Callie. I'm happy to be here.
And I love that one of your earliest memories is watching a mare deliver her foal. I have an animal sciences background, and so many people are surprised that I made a switch from animals or livestock to humans. And I feel like I have to remind them that humans are mammals. And when it comes to birth, we have the same basic needs, quiet, security, and those things are universal across the species.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So let's start by unpacking and defining some terms so our listeners can understand kind of what we're talking about and they can understand you and your mission and as a nurse and an educator. Can you define for us two things first, trauma-informed care and empowered birth choices? Those are big concepts. So can you unpack those?
Big word. Sure. Yeah. So trauma-informed care just works around the idea that a lot of women have been exposed to trauma through various points in their life. And this is true, especially of Indigenous populations, and persons of color have a higher incidence of domestic violence and prior assault. And what people don't realize is that often in childbirth, these experiences can resurface because of where people feel pain in their body or of showing up in a hospital where they're not in control and it's an uncomfortable environment. And so the patterns and the feelings in the nervous system that happen when somebody has been through trauma can then resurface. And we unknowingly, as providers, if we aren't coming into the situation with this in mind, we can actually re-traumatize someone. And so trauma-informed care focuses on kind of creating a safe space, offering choices, asking the person for collaboration, and developing trust so that it changes the perspective from a passive observer to an active participant in their care. And this can make a difference. You know, we hear about some traumatic births where the outcomes are really sad or not what we would desire at all for a birth. And depending on how the family is treated in labor, it can make a difference in how they recover from those. So, you know, some birth trauma is preventable, some of it is not, but how we approach those situations can make all the difference in how that family is able to cope with the outcomes of that birth. And then it also comes at it from an angle of when, I'm sure as a nurse, you have seen yourself patients that are labeled as difficult. And it changes that perspective. Instead of asking what's wrong with you, we ask what happened to you. And then we try to come at it from that perspective. And then your second question, the empowered birth really follows that same kind of principle, the collaborative caregiving experience, helping people to understand what the process of labor is, because as you pointed out at the beginning about mammalian birth, so many people are not familiar with that concept, that people need safety and security and food and water and even darkness, like low light levels. They need to be able to go into their bodies for their bodies to respond hormonally and physiologically the way that they were meant to in order for labor to progress like it's supposed to. And so having the knowledge about what's happening to bodies, having choices and feeling safe and secure is going to help kind of all of that go like it's supposed to. Yeah. So that we have to use less interventions.
So that kind of leads into my next question is, what kind of benefits do you see when you really use that approach? When you really come at, and you may not know that a person has experienced trauma, and it may be birth-related trauma, or it could be, from what I'm hearing, it could be any type of trauma, sexual trauma in their past. How do you, I guess, approach someone if you do or don't know about their trauma history? And then what kind of benefits do you see when you adopt that approach?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. I like the point that you brought up, whether we know or not. And that's part of trauma-informed care, is that we don't really ask. It's not our business, and it's not the patient's responsibility to tell us that story over and over again. If they want to share, that's fine. But we should just assume in today's culture that most people have been through something traumatic. And even if they haven't, this is still the right way to go of, you know, empowering and giving people choice and the best care that we can, really that therapeutic listening and informed consent or informed choice. And the benefits are that we use less interventions. And when people have better birth outcomes, that's a better start to parenting. And it's really the start of a healthy humanity. It starts with, you know, preconception health, birth experiences, how they view their world as parents and families and their role in it, their confidence in their ability to then raise their children. And breastfeeding goes along with that, which we know affects global health. So breastfeeding reduces risk of cancer, diabetes, obesity, and lots of other things, which cost our country a lot of money and a lot of healthcare outcomes. So those are all tied together, and it starts with that very basic human care.
I'm going to jump forward. I have one more thing that I want you to kind of define, but you've touched on an important point about how breastfeeding helps support babies and moms. And you kind of touched on something. Can breastfeeding have economic impacts in the United States and then maybe even globally?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think the CDC's Surgeon General even has a statistic out there that says something like $13 billion a year in the U.S. could be saved on healthcare costs if 90% of families were able to follow the recommendation to breastfeed for 6 months. I'll just say that number again. That's $13 billion a year. So absolutely. And it has impact for health for mom and baby, but it also impacts future generations. So we know with epigenetic changes now, we're seeing the offspring of the infants that were breastfed also get benefits from that, as well as, you know, economic impacts for cost of formula and environmental impacts. I mean, really impacts global health in so many ways that we haven't even thought about measuring yet.
And that $13 billion in savings, is that mostly seen just by healthcare, like these infants and mothers are healthier, so we're spending less on healthcare right. needs? Insurance, that sort of thing.
Reduce risk of ovarian and breast cancer for the moms, and reduce childhood illnesses in the infants.
And why do you think we have such a hard time? Again, I'm jumping forward because we kind of got on this train. Why do you think that we don't see that success? Why don't you think we see that 90%? What are some obstacles?
Yeah, ooh, that's a question, right? There are so many facets to that, because I think, you know, as a lactation consultant and a registered nurse, I teach all of the families breastfeeding is best. It's so beneficial. And here's all of the reasons, right? The epigenetics and the reduction in illnesses and all these things. But the reality is we don't have the support to make that happen in our culture or in our healthcare system. And so on top of that is an added layer of guilt when people can't successfully breastfeed. And it's a really hard line to walk and to balance as a lactation consultant to meet families where they're at, to support whatever they can for breastfeeding. And sometimes that means exclusively pumping. And sometimes that means mixed feeding. And sometimes that means we have to use formula. But all of that, I think, comes down to lack of support, lack of education, and our postpartum healthcare system, which is basically non-existent. If you ask me, we have like tons of prenatal visits, how many, 10, 15 sometimes, and one postpartum visit at maybe 6 to 8 weeks, which doesn't address really any of the needs, and lack of insurance companies, often people have to fight to get their lactation consultants covered. We don't have home visits routinely, so people have to pack everything up, come into the hospital, and then paid parental leave. So some of these families are going back to work at 1 and 2 weeks postpartum. How do you support that? How do you feed a baby that needs to wake every 1 to 3 hours and likes to feed at night because that's the biological norm? How do you balance that with trying to get an income? So it's a loaded question.
Yeah, for sure. And I actually just wrote an article myself in response to a Newsweek article that was talking about that topic specifically, that the fact that we kind of leave moms behind after they have a baby. Like, we have all of these planned visits for infants and we're very on it, right? Like 24 hours after they leave the hospital, it's like,
right.
And like, but moms, it's like, oh, see you in 6 weeks. Good luck, you know? And
right.
I think some hospitals are starting to bridge that gap with like phone calls and stuff. But I do, and I think you answered this question. Do you think the current healthcare system leaves postpartum mothers behind?
And yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When it comes to postpartum depression, when it comes to pelvic floor health post delivery, most people don't even know that there's such things as pelvic floor exercises, and it goes beyond Kegels, and there's a whole realm there, and support for breastfeeding, after. I work at a baby-friendly facility, but there aren't postpartum, services after for home visits or anything like that set up through public health. So,
yeah. It seems like, at least from where I stand, and I've only been a nurse for the last 5 years, it seems like, in my eyes, breastfeeding and the new designation of baby friendly has really become popular and has really had some great success. Do you agree? Do you think we're getting somewhere?
Yeah, I like the baby friendly program, but I think that it has brought to light that additional problem that we were just talking about. So the baby friendly hospital initiative works to promote the breastfeeding and breast milk as the ideal first nutrition. We encourage rooming in so that parents learn to recognize their baby's feeding cues and they can work together as a team and figure those things out, but it doesn't address what comes after, so we do need that other piece of it. We need support after and more education.
Right. We can't just expect women to leave the hospital and feel like they've got to handle on it after.
Yeah. Especially because those first few days of breastfeeding are just practice, for the baby. They get little bits of colostrum and that's all good. But what happens on day 3 when the milk comes in, there's engorgement, the baby not, all the things. Lack of sleep.
Some of my dear friends have had challenges with this. So I'm sure they're eager to listen to what you have to say. But so let's step back, because I feel like, we've been talking about breastfeeding, that's great, and taking moms home and postpartum care. But I feel like sometimes there's no success because their birth experience has been, I hate using this word all the time because I feel like it's being overused, but it is. It's so traumatic, or they're so exhausted, or they've labored for 3 or 4 days and then they ended up a C-section, and then we like, here's your baby, feed it, And I feel like we need to take a step back and talk more about the birth experience, that is, and pregnancy and birth experience as it affects, those postpartum. So what does physiological birth mean? What does that mean? And how does that differ from or mirror what most women experience in the healthcare system?
So physiologic birth is basically a birth that, and labor and delivery all the way to the placenta that happens without medical intervention. So when our bodies go into labor on their own without induction, the babies are born without cesarean or vacuums or forceps, or and the placenta comes out on its own without drugs or pulling on it or anything like that. And we can promote physiologic birth if we understand mammalian birth. We can promote physiologic birth a lot better. I don't feel that most women in the U.S. have an equal opportunity to experience physiologic birth, because just the obstetric model of care is very high intervention. So we over monitor sometimes, and we over intervene sometimes with inductions and so forth. I mean, the answer to that is multifaceted, or the, I guess not the answer, but the reason for that is multifaceted. I think we're seeing more high risk pregnancies than we used to. And so that's a whole other, you know, a whole other topic, which there are ways to still support that physiologic birth environment, even when we do have to use interventions. And that works by using less, you know, if we support that mammalian birth, we're using less intervention. But also, and what I focus on too, is realizing that low risk pregnancies are still being treated medically in the obstetric system. So we know that midwifery care, midwifery model of care, home births, freestanding birth centers are appropriate and safe for low-risk pregnancies, but we don't, people don't have access to them, and they aren't widely accepted.
Right. Well, in my experience too, like, for, you know, insurance will pay for a hospital birth, but they won't right. pay for a birth center birth, which to right. me is just like...
right. Even though we have the data to back up that they have actually better outcomes than we do for low risk women.
Right.
Yeah. And I think that if we want to get to the root cause of all this, I would say that it's fear-based and litigation-based. We over-monitor in obstetrics because we're afraid of lawsuits or afraid of outcomes, and because we have this kind of mantra of all that matters is a healthy baby. And we have to get away from that, because healthy baby, healthy mom is absolutely our goal. I'm not saying that's not our goal, but it has to encompass mental health. And when we don't give people informed choices and body autonomy and the opportunity to experience trauma-informed care, then we take away some of that. And it will present later in mental health challenges, which affect the whole family. But really, if we're talking about that concept of mammalian birth for people that have never kind of thought about it in this way before, I'll tell you that when I was growing up and that very first birth that I witnessed, the foal and my mare, the lights were off in the barn. There was clean hay for her to eat if she wished. There was clean water for her to drink if she wished. She was in kind of a back corner of the barn where she felt safe, and it was dark and quiet. And I remember my grandmother like, shh, we talk in whispers, you know, and we're just here if she needs us, but otherwise don't disturb her. And later I came to understand that when we disturb normal physiologic birth, for example, you know, I'm sure you've seen this too, where somebody comes into the hospital after they've called and said, I've been contracting every 2 or 3 minutes for, you know, 2 hours and getting a little uncomfortable, and I'm going to go ahead and come in. And they come in and we have bright lights and we have a ton of questions and an IV star, all these things, and suddenly they're not contracting at all. Yeah. Why is that? It's because we turned on the thinking part of the brain and the mammalian part of the brain that needs to feel safe in order for labor to progress, shut off. And that happens a lot in the hospital. We have to learn how to kind of support those safe spaces to allow the body to do what it needs to do.
In our emails prior to this call, you mentioned that you believe we've lost the wisdom of our ancestors and the support of our families in this pregnancy. Is that kind of what you're hitting on here? Or would you say that there's more to unpack there? Like, what wisdom and what are we losing? And then how do we heal that?
I would say the answer to that question is yes, both. Like, that is kind of what I'm saying, but there's a lot more to it.
Okay, go ahead. Give us more.
If we think about historically what birth has looked like in the past 1,000 years versus the past 100, we can see where we've lost that wisdom. So my great-grandmothers and grandmothers, I would say at least my grandmothers, I don't know if it goes back as far as great-grandmother. Yeah, it does. So if I go back to my great grandmother and my grandmother's, you know, that was kind of the twilight sleep, knock everybody out, deliver with forceps kind of thing. And if I go back to my mother, it was more of the, you know, forced cesareans or moving out of the home birth into the hospital birth. And then so that's 3 generations of knowledge around normal physiologic birth and mammalian birth and the support that birthing women and families need into the postpartum period that we've lost. So we've moved away from women supporting families in birth through midwifery. And that historical knowledge of what normal physiologic birth looks like, and also the recovery time. So in a lot of cultures around the world, a lot of other countries, the postpartum period is treated as very sacred, and the woman is waited on with special foods and special ceremonies and special exercises or bindings of the abdomen to kind of pull everything together in this very reverenced atmosphere that doesn't exist in the US today. So when I say we've lost that historical wisdom, our bodies have lost that wisdom and our brains have lost that wisdom.
And our culture.
And our culture.
You have that too. Yeah. Like, it is interesting when you hear of someone as a labor and delivery nurse say that they want to, as a hospital labor and delivery nurse, let me caveat that, say that they want to birth at home or have a midwife at a birth center. The first thing people think about is, oh, well, what if something goes wrong? What if you know, and it's like, we don't think of the first thing of your body is made for that. That's great. You know?
Yes. And you bring an interesting point there. What if something goes wrong? And the thing is that lots of things go wrong in the hospital too. And sometimes we're actually perpetuating that by using, you know, unnecessary interventions. And I think that comes back to the trauma-informed care as well. When we offer people choices and we educate them about what their choices are and we talk about risks, benefits, and alternatives, then that puts the decision in their realm. Our job is not to decide what's safe and what's not safe for people. That's not our job as providers or nurses. It's our job to provide evidence-based information and then let the family make the choice. Because for some people, especially people who have been victims of trauma, the hospital is not a safe place for them at all.
Right.
And I know that's kind of like an out there, like that will make some people stand up and say, what? But that's not our responsibility. We really need to give the choices back to the families, and it's our job to educate.
Right. Well, and I think that someone once described the hospital as feeling unsafe to people in this way. And it really helped me, but you have this person walk in to a place that they may or may not have been before. And we strip them of their identity, really. We take their clothes off of them. We put them in a gown, much like prison. They have to wear the same uniform, you know, all the patients. And then we limit the number of people that they know and love around them. And then we have people, I've worked in a teaching hospital in the past, several, and lots of people in and out. And these are people that they don't know. And so, you know, that can feel very alarming to people. And I think we kind of forget that. We hook them up to strange things. And as a nurse, I always try to humanize it a little bit. If I have a patient that needs to be on medication, I'm like, okay, this IV pole, pretend it's a vacuum. You can push it anywhere. You take the medical out of it. Like, this is just your vacuum cleaner or whatever, you know? So, I think it's important for healthcare workers who are in the hospital to remember that these patients, this is unfamiliar, even if they've been there.
Yeah. And there's things that we can do to make it, you know, some people, it is the best place for them to be in the hospital, or it's where they feel most comfortable because they don't feel comfortable delivering at home. And these are the things that we need to look at as birth workers when we're looking at hospital policy. Does really everybody have to wear a hospital gown? No, that's silly. They can wear their own clothes. You know, does everybody have to have continuous fetal monitoring? Nope. We have evidence to support, you know, intermittent monitoring. And especially in this time of COVID, I really think that we should look at doula and family support and how really important that is to a family's birth experience. And they're going home with the people in their family, right? We aren't protecting them from COVID by keeping them away.
Isolating them. Yeah. I was really shocked and appalled when hospitals weren't even allowing visitors. I thought that was the most unethical, most inhumane way to treat people, not just labor and delivery, but just everywhere. It just seemed really, was really disheartened by all of that. But at least things seem to be reversing. So something we've talked about on a global level, especially in this period of COVID, I think something we're seeing in the healthcare industry is a struggle to maintain bodily autonomy in this healthcare system. And do you see this where you work in that, or just in general in women's health, like this lack of bodily autonomy?
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's driven by fear and just how our medical care system is set up to just make it practice. You know, when I was trained as a labor and delivery nurse 13 years ago, we weren't taught to ask consent before we did a vaginal exam. We weren't taught to ask consent before we touch someone. Can I touch your belly? You know, we do touch stomachs when we are assessing contractions, like to feel with our hands, you know, because it's just the monitor. Sometimes it doesn't tell the truth. But are we taught to ask, is it okay if I touch your belly? No, we aren't taught those things. But it's so important if we look at it from the person that's laboring, from their perspective, they're in their body doing this extremely difficult thing. And when we are doing things that are painful or invasive, and how many of us like to be touched by strangers without permission? I don't. In fact, when I've done that exercise of like, how close can you get to somebody before you feel like that? It's like 10 feet. And I'm like, you're fine. Right. Mm-hmm. And so we put people in this vulnerable position and then we forget that there's a human there and we need to ask consent before we do vaginal exam, before we touch anybody.
Right.
And it's absolutely not okay. I want that to be known to all families everywhere. It is not okay for a provider or nurse to touch you without permission ever. And no is a complete sentence. Yeah. But also like understanding that most of these things are not malicious. You know, people don't make people feel uncomfortable or hurt them intentionally. As healthcare providers, we exist in that realm because we want to help people. But it's a culture change that needs to happen. And it's based in a fear and a need to control what's going on.
That's a really important point. And I hope that our healthcare workers who are listening and our families that are listening got both sides of that. You know, like it's okay to say no, and it's okay to expect to be asked for things and the reverse. Like we need to ask and we need to be very cognizant of how the other person is feeling and dealing with what they're going through. Please.
Oh, I was just going to say that goes back to that trauma-informed care as well. If you have a trusting relationship with your nurses and providers and they are using a trauma-informed approach, then when things happen, like you and I know that can happen sometimes that are really scary, a cord prolapse or something like that, where the baby is truly in danger. When you have that trusting relationship with your nurses and your providers, and when they have used the trauma-informed approach, it's not going to be traumatic when they say, I'm really sorry, but I have to do this thing right now. Right. That's not the same as if you don't have that relationship and people feel violated for things that aren't emergent, they're not going to see the emergency. There's just going to be another attack. And so if you can work to establish these relationships and use that trauma-informed care and establish trust, then that's going to make everything go better when you're working as a team with families and birth workers and doctors and everybody's on the same page.
Yeah, I always really appreciate too as a nurse when those emergencies kind of come up, either other nurses doing the hands-on work so I can be up near the patient and telling them exactly as it's happened, this is what's happening. You're going to feel this touch. You're going to, and just kind of be there, or have another nurse like pop in. I always appreciate that in a team approach because it does really, like, someone's acknowledging this person as a person and acknowledging their mental and emotional health and while all these other things are going on in the setting.
Yes. So,
we talked a little bit about how interventions have gone up because we're seeing more high risk pregnancies. And I think you're right on there. I actually just did a research study that's pending publication looking at surrogates. We compared their own pregnancy experiences with their surrogacy pregnancy experiences. And we saw, obviously, surrogate pregnancies are high risk, but we saw increase in C-sections and we saw increase in postpartum depression, which I thought was really interesting. And then at the very end of the study, we asked them, you know, is there something you'd like to say that we didn't ask you about? Or do you have any other comments? And a lot of women talked about whether or not they could pump or provide breast milk for their surrogate child. And I thought that was really interesting. A lot of women felt really sad that they had to bind their breasts and couldn't breastfeed that child. And so I'm just wondering, I know you don't take care of many, if any, surrogate mothers, but do you have any insight to that? Like, if a woman goes home without a child and she's not pumping, do you think that could play into this postpartum depression and then maybe even long-term care issues or health issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's probably a twofold reason for that. One would be the mental difficulty of having the physical reminder, the full breast, the leaking milk, that there was a baby there and now there's not, for whatever reason, or even if they do have a baby at home but are not able to use that breast milk, whether it's because of a medication they're on or some issue with the baby. So there's that component, but But there's also another component that's not as well known. And Kathleen Kendall Tackett has done some great research on this about the hormones and physiologic role of breastfeeding in reducing inflammation in the body and the hormone effects of oxytocin, which is a mood booster. And so we know that inflammation is wreaks havoc on the body, and it causes chronic illnesses, and it also increases your risk of depression. And so there's an anti-inflammatory kind of cytokine response that I can't explain the whole science behind, but she can, that happens when people are breastfeeding and when moms are breastfeeding, and also the oxytocin, which is a mood elevator, and those two work together to actually decrease your risk of postpartum depression. And so it is really interesting that you kind of saw that correlation there.
Yeah. I wish, you know, after you design a study, you always have like other questions. You're like, oh, but I wish we would have asked more about that. We, you know, it was over 100 and some questions, and we left out like whether or not they breastfed and how that affected them. But right, it's a follow-up study to be had, I'm sure.
Yeah. And if you want to look up some of Kathleen Kendall Tackett's research, she's on Preclaris Press, and she has really great information around breastfeeding and mental health. But I think that was published in the International Breastfeeding Journal.
Wow,
maybe as far back as like 2007-ish. It's been around for a while.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, a surrogacy, and you mentioned that like it's been a while, around for a while. These like best practices for breastfeeding have been around, and we're increasing baby friendly, and we talk about the importance of skin to skin afterwards for that baby to be next to its birth mother. And yet we do things like surrogacy, which are like completely against, we're removing a baby from that space that it's known. We're not breastfeeding. Right. We might be bottle feeding, you know, and I'm just like, oh, so baby friendly doesn't matter in those cases, but right. I digress.
No, it's really interesting. You bring up an interesting point about healthcare in general, especially women's health. We have research from as long as 15 to 20 years ago that talk about the importance of trauma-informed care and low-risk birth options for low-risk mothers, and the importance of the midwifery model of care and the importance of breastfeeding. And yet, 20 years later, we still have systems in place that do continuous monitoring for low-risk pregnancies, even though we have like zero evidence to say that that improves outcomes, and even a small body of evidence that says it worsens outcomes. So like, how do we change that? And this is something I really struggle with as the labor and delivery nurse, and like balancing burnout when I know that we can do better and be better, but there's resistance from a system that I really have no power to change.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. Or at least it feels that way. I do believe that we, you know, even small change, and even, you know,
yeah,
I remind myself when I get discouraged like that, that if I can provide a really great birth experience for one woman, then I'm empowering that change, because then she tells the other woman that's her friend that becomes pregnant, I had a really great birth experience and I felt really empowered. And, you know, and I think eventually, you know, we'll get to where women are feeling more and more empowered to do what
they want. And I do see that slow change. It's just not fast enough.
Yeah, no, I want it now.
I want it now.
Yeah.
And I want it, you know, 20 years ago when the research came out.
Well, yes. So I tend to believe that good nurses are really great educators like yourself. And I know that is at the core of who you are. And you provide education for nurses through your consultation business. What do you think is the most important thing for nurses to learn? If you could be like, devote a practice to learn this, what would it be?
Therapeutic communication. Yeah. I mean, you can not bypass it altogether. Like, please understand mammalian birth and how to support that. But if you can develop therapeutic communication and learn to see yourself in a role as an educator and a giver of information instead of the person that needs to control a situation that's going on, or just checking boxes for tasks. If you can really change the mindset to be as your role there to support and provide information, and then use therapeutic communication, which is, you know, mostly listening, that's going to change the family's experience no matter what happens in that birth. I'll give an example. So I have twins the first time, and my second birth was an attempted VBAC. So preeclampsia and C-section the first time, and attempted VBAC the second time. In both of those instances, my nurses and my doctors did not treat me I didn't have body autonomy, didn't have autonomy and choice. I didn't have informed consent, and I didn't really even understand with the preeclampsia what was going on. I just felt like all these choices were being made without me. And some of the choices that were made absolutely needed to happen, and some of them not so much in the first and second births. But the way in which I processed those had everything to do with the approach of the care team. It was very much, we are going to do these things now. And that was it. And in my last birth, I had a very traumatic physical outcome. So, again, attempted a VBAC, ended up with a uterine rupture, ended up on the table for 3.5 hours getting stitched back together. And then, another surgery the next day and bladder injury. And it was just a mess. But in that birth, even though I didn't get the birth outcome I'd worked so hard for, and I ended up with some pretty traumatic physical things, I was part of the care team the entire time. So my physician discussed everything she was doing. She gave me choices. She listened when I said, I know everything looks fine on the monitor, but I feel like something's wrong and I'm done being in labor and I want to go to a C-section. Yep. Okay. 5 minutes, I was back. And all I said was, I feel like something's not right. That's it.
She listened to that.
And then the baby stayed with me the entire time. The anesthesiologist said, would you like something to make you sleepy because you're going to be on the table for a while? And I said, no, thanks. I want to be awake. I want to remember. So all of that, even though it was the hardest physically on my body, it was so much easier to recover from because I felt like I was part of the process. I was an active participant in things that were happening to me versus a passive observer in things that were being done to me.
Yeah. You didn't have to afterwards kind of go through again what happened and why it happened. You were present in each of those
right
conversations and moments. So it's like,
it's huge.
Yeah. So that being said, what do you think is the best thing an expectant mother or family can do for herself or themselves to prepare for the birth of their child?
Education. Yeah. People are pregnant for, women are pregnant for 9-10 months, 40 weeks, give or take. And lots of times there's lots of focus on newborn baby stuff and what crib to buy and what carrier works. And there's all of this stuff in between. And it doesn't start with just the prenatal class at 30 weeks. It really should start preconception. There's a lot of things nutritionally that can increase your chance of having a healthy pregnancy. There is a lot of things that if you've had a history of domestic violence or trauma or assault or any of those things, seek help before even preconception, because we know that with epigenetics, with the study of that, the trauma that happens to the mom beforehand can even influence some genetic changes in the baby later. It's really fascinating as it looks at our whole picture of global health. But spend some real time and energy educating yourself on everything for your pregnancy. What risk factors do you have? What can you do to mitigate those? What do you want your birth to look like? And I encourage everyone to write a birth plan. And I know some L&D nurses kind of roll their eyes when they see them come in the door, but that's really a roadmap for your experience. And it helps us as nurses to know what we can give you to make your birth experience better. And it's not just for people that want an all-natural birth. Mm-hmm. Some people really would benefit from an epidural if they've been through some sort of traumatic assault or even a really traumatic first delivery. It can help the body relax if they aren't prepared to kind of feel those same things again. So, yes, if you want an epidural, put that in your birth plan. It helps us to support your choices. And that's really what birth should be about.
And I think it starts the conversation for an informed consent, even though nurses aren't the ones usually providing that conversation. But I think it's like, that's one of the first questions I ask is, do you have a birth plan? And then I read over it. And then we talk about, why this, maybe why not that. And it starts the dialogue. I get to know the patient better. I get to know, if they want more education on something, sometimes they'll put a question mark. They're not sure. So we'll talk about it. I think it just opens the dialogue. If anything, it's like, I see all these wonderful things you have. This is what we're going to try to do. This is great. And just kind of starts a conversation. So I encourage people to do that too. If anything, to help have a conversation.
Exactly. And to identify where there might be some needs for more education as well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Our time is running out. Do you have anything else that you would like to say either to birth workers around the country, or I will include your, maybe you want to talk about for a second, your, your business as a consultant. I'll include a link to that below for any healthcare workers that want to get to know what Jasmine does more. But would you maybe like to end by talking about that a little bit?
Sure. I would just say to all my fellow birth workers, I know that this job is physically and emotionally difficult, but it's such important work that we are doing. It's not just about the immediate outcome, right? It's not just about good Epgars. We really have to start using our knowledge around physiologic birth and mammalian birth to support low intervention birth and to support good birth experiences so that families have a healthy start. We know from the ACEs study that adverse childhood events are bad, right? Let's stop talking about that and start talking about how we build healthy families so that we reduce the incidence of things like postpartum depression and all the, you know, increase our breastfeeding rates, all of those things. And it's a hard change. It's a hard culture shift that needs to happen. But I know that there are birth workers out there that see every day where things could be better. Please don't be afraid to speak out. I know it's scary. I know it's scary. But we are the voices of these women that we care for, and we really just have to speak the truth and recognize kind of where culture needs to shift. And don't be afraid to stand up and say that. There, you're not alone.
That's wonderful.
Might feel like you're alone sometimes, but you're not alone.
Yeah. That's great advice. Thank you, Jasmine. And thank you so much for being here with me today and taking time to talk with all of us at Venus Rising. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. This kind of stuff fills my cup. So
it does. I love talking. I mean, I could talk to you forever. So we might have to have you back maybe if we get some questions. But yeah, so this wraps up our time with Jasmine. Thank you all for listening in at Venus Rising. I am Callie Fell, your host, and you can always email me with questions, comments, concerns at callie.fell@cbc-network.org. And if you like our show, please don't hesitate to give us a review. We look forward to seeing you next time on Venus Rising. Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.